Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
When he joined the New York Knicks, he turned the team from a contender into a championship winner. But it was what he did before he joined the Knicks that helped him become a Hall of Fame forward. And that included pitching for the Chicago White Sox and being named the youngest coach in NBA history before his trade to the Knicks. Next on Sports Forgotten Heroes, the remarkable and forgotten story of Dave DeBuscher.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shaped the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. In just a moment, Bill Pruden, a member of SABRE, the Society for American Baseball Research, will be joining us to talk about one of the greatest New York Knicks ever, Dave DeBuscher. Now, you might be asking why have a guest on the podcast who writes biographies about baseball players talk about a basketball player? Well, the answer is simple. Before DeBuscher became such a great basketball player, in fact, he was named one of the 50 best in NBA history, he was a pitcher for the Chicago White Sox. Now, before we get to DeBuscher and Bill Pruden, I just want to let you all know that this episode of Sports Forgotten Heroes is sponsored by Audible. With Audible, you get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Audible is a great way to show your support for Sports Forgotten Heroes and a terrific way to listen to your favorite books, especially when you're on the run. Give it a try free at www.audibletrial.com/sportsfh. I have several audiobooks in my queue now, some of which I have listened to for Sports Forgotten Heroes. Check out Audible. It's really a great service, and some of the talent to read the books is really, really good. And it's free for 30 days. I also invite you to visit the Sports Forgotten Heroes Patreon page at patreon.com/sportsfh. That's patreon.com/sportsfh. Every day there's a sports quiz, information on upcoming podcasts, historical notes about sports, the heroes we talk about, and there's a lot more coming too. It's also a great way to show your support for Sports Forgotten Heroes. Again, that's patreon.com/sportsfh. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes and look for our page on Facebook or visit Sports Forgotten Heroes on the web at sportsfh.com. So how good a pitcher was Dave DeBuscher? Well, the White Sox thought he was so good that they let future two-time Cy Young Award winner Denny McClain go in favor of keeping him. And Dave didn't disappoint, at least on the minor league level, where he put up some hefty numbers going 43-25 over four seasons with a 3.43 ERA and 28 complete games. With the big club, however, DeBuscher appeared in just 36 games over two seasons, starting 10 of them, and he went 3-4 with a 2.90 ERA. But the White Sox didn't keep him on the big club, and the Pistons liked him so much that after just two seasons with the team, and at the incredibly young age of 24, Detroit named him player coach. Now, that's a lot of pressure for someone so young, but what an incredible honor, and man, does that say a lot about your basketball acumen. And here to tell us more about Dave DeBuscher is Bill Pruden.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
So tell me about SABRE and your involvement and why you remember. What you find so interesting about SABRE?
Well, I'm a longtime baseball fan, and like so many people for organizations like this, a friend of mine made me aware of the organization. I looked into it, and I've really enjoyed it. I mean, there's an awful lot of great information, a lot of sharing of great stuff, just interactions with lots of fellow baseball fans. And that's also one of the things I like about it is it really approaches the game from a wide range of directions. You know, I think there's the you hear about it in Major League, the sabermetrics kind of stuff, but as my involvement's been more kind of historical, narrative type stuff as opposed to statistical, and Saber supports that just as fully as they do the number crunchers.
So tell me some of the people who you have written bios about.
Well, I actually started, I've only written four bios, but they've been sort of personal, I guess you'd say. Dave DeBuscher is one. I grew up a big New York Knicks fan, knew he had played both baseball and played for the Knicks in the NBA, and thought, you know, looked into it and saw that was available and thought, all right, I'm going to jump on this one. The other one in the first sets that I did was actually based off of one of my great baseball memories. The second major league game I ever went to was the game that Roger Maris hit his 61st home run in.
Wow, that's awesome.
I grew up in northern New Jersey, and I constantly thought about this when McGuire and Sosa were chasing the records and they were selling out every time. But I say the morning of the final Yankee game that season, my father looked at the paper and said to me and my younger brother, said, you know, we could see some history today, and literally drove across the bridge, which was all it took. As I say, I grew up right out in Bergen County, right outside New York City. And we're there when it happened. So when I found out about the Sabre bios, I checked into it and nobody had written on Maris. So they, assigned me that one, and that was the first one I did. And then I figured,
wow, that's really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, it was. So I wrote on that one, and then I kind of figured I'd expand a little bit, and then wrote on Tracy Stallard, who gave up Maris' 61st home run, and Jack Fisher, who did the 60th. So, and then I've actually written one article for the games. You know, they're doing the history of the game report, and I did that game was available. So I wrote on the game that Maris hit the home run in.
Well, you certainly have
my little niche.
Yeah, you certainly have a unique perspective on it for sure. Hey, let's start here. First, tell me about your love for Dave DeBuscher and what listeners of Sports Forgotten Heroes might not understand is the love. And that's not a word to use loosely. That New York fans had a love for the Knicks of the 1970s and Dave DeBuscher, a real love. Tell me about that.
Oh, they really did. It was, I think part of it was a city and a team that had been starved for basketball excellence for so long. And I also think that while each of the members of that team had their own kind of fan base, I mean, it was an extraordinary team. Willis Reed at center, Walt Frazier and Dick Barnett on the first championship team at guards, DeBuscher and Bill Bradley at the forwards, and a bench that included Cassie Russell and Mike Reardon, Dave Stallworth, and then the second championship 3 years later that substituted Earl Monroe for Dick Barnett, who'd retired, and they added Jerry Lucas for additional depth. So, I mean, you know, each of them, it's a lot of Hall of Fame members, but there was a personality to it. I think Bradley had an image, obviously, that was very distinctive. Reed was just a warrior, and his seventh game appearance the year they won the first championship was, you know, one of the NBA's arguably all-time great moments. And DeBuscher was right in the middle, and I think, you know, by most basketball experts would say that he was kind of the missing piece. The trade that brought him to the Knicks brought just a beyond quality player, but also freed Reed up to move back to center from the forward he was playing. It was the final piece in a puzzle, and just added another dimension. I mean, it was I think you'd be hard pressed to find a basketball team that had a higher basketball IQ, in terms of that group. And again, DeBuscher, people tend to forget it, but he was not only an all-star, but he was also a former coach,
Right. And we're going to get to that.
He was a player coach for the Pistons.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment. What kind of player was he, though, and just how good was he?
DeBuscher was just reflective of his, to a cliche, reflective of his upbringing. He was a real, Detroit native and was a real blue collar guy. You know, he was a good scorer. I mean, his career average, I think, was 16 points a game in a day when that was more than it is today, kind of thing. But rebounding and the tough defensive assignments were the real core of what he did and the toughness that he brought to that team. And his own, again, his basketball knowledge, instincts, and all were just another in a piece of a very high.
Your piece on Dave really covered a lot, and I guess everyone knew that Dave was really something special all the way back in high school in Detroit, as you had talked about. He's from Detroit. He led his high school basketball team to championships, and he did the same with his high school baseball team as well, and then he did it again in college at the University of Detroit, where he led the Titans to NCAA and NIT appearances. He also led them to NCAA appearances on the diamond as well. Now, while some listeners might be familiar with just how good a basketball player he was, not many might realize just how good a pitcher he was. Tell me about Dave as a baseball player.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he had a solid record, but as we know in baseball, perhaps more than others, sometimes it takes time, and I don't know that he ever really got that. But you know, had a solid record, had some couple real good minor league years, and got brought up near the end and did stuff. But you know, the basketball infringed on a little bit there. You know, he had it written into his contract that he could do it. So there were times he could get the spring training late if the basketball went long. And so baseball never really got the full attention that it was probably necessary to fulfill it. But I know, you know, to my mind, and again, it's one of those kind of things that sports trivia experts absolutely love, but arguably the best indicator of at least the potential that baseball people saw with Dave was the fact that at one point the White Sox had to make a decision based on the rules at the time in terms of who could be sent down and, you know, how many miles, those kind of things. But they had to make a decision between two of their roster pitchers to keep and, you know, who they kept and who they were going to let go. And the guy they let go was Denny McClain.
Incredible.
And I think that says a lot. You know, obviously you don't know how it would have worked out, but they saw in the Buescher enough to you know, make that decision.
Well, obviously back then, baseball had much deeper pockets than the NBA did. And when he graduated from college, he had a really difficult choice ahead of him. Does he sign with the White Sox, who drafted him and offered him a hefty $75,000 signing bonus, or does he sign with the Pistons, who claimed him as a territorial pick for $15,000? So, as you said, he did both, but the White Sox had to have seen a ton of potential in him to offer him such a signing bonus, did they not?
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure that's a big piece. I mean, you know, I think he was obviously a tremendously talented athlete, and both sides were trying to convince him to come to them. I mean, there's speculation that the reason he was named player coach for the Pistons was that, all right, if he's got that responsibility, maybe he's finally going to give up this silly baseball thing, which is certainly how the Pistons saw it. But, you know, I think you've got a guy who was not only talented, he was obviously a tremendous competitor, and I think that was a part of it. You know, as you look back on it, and it, you know, who knows, in retrospect, it may have been part of why his heart gave out when he did, that he'd just given it his all and dying young. But, I mean, I think this was a guy who was just had to compete and needed to do it almost 12 months a year kind of thing, and, you know, didn't step away from that.
The commitment to both sports. I mean, especially today, players keep themselves in shape all year round for their particular sport. The commitment he must have had to have made back then to play baseball for X number of months a year and to play basketball for X number of months a year had to be huge, but he sure did give it a try.
Yeah, he was a tremendous competitor. I mean, his teammates all talked about that, and a real leader in that way too. I mean, that example, and know, it's not something you see today, even at lower levels, to play at that level in the majors. So much of, and I say this as a father and as a high school educator, you know, the kids are specializing so early nowadays. And I, you know, we're not after seeing the Busher again, not just because Dave DeBuscher was a unique person, but the whole landscape of sports has changed so much.
Well, he sure did give it a try. Can you tell us a little bit about his career with the White Sox?
Yeah, I mean, he never had never really had a full season. It was always kind of the ups and downs. His overall career was a solid one. Barely 100 hours, but I mean, 100 innings pitched, 3-4. His ERA, though, was under 3. So, I mean, there was always the indicators, but in part because of basketball, he never really got the full thing. I mean, he never had a full-scale spring training because basketball always overlaps, so he was really kind of catching up. And so he'd be brought up late. The NBA started a little later in those days, so he was able to finish out some seasons, and that was where he got it. But he was always kind of running from behind when the season started, then send him down to work on it and get things rolling in the minors. He has a couple of good, some real good minor league seasons. Right near the end, he had a AAA season with Indianapolis where he was 15-12 and an ERA of 3.65, which was nothing to sneeze at at that time. With his size too, he was a real workhorse too, in a way that we don't see in the same way nowadays. He was putting in a lot of innings. And
so he was doing pretty well with the Pistons at the same time,
right.
And he had become somewhat frustrated with the White Sox because they wouldn't promote him to the majors. They
right.
kept him down in the minors.
Yep.
And didn't he think that he had done well enough to earn a spot with the team after spring training of 1964?
Yep. That's my understanding. He reached the point where it's like, give me the chance. I feel like I've earned it. And when that didn't come, it wasn't worth it to continue burning the candle at both ends if one of those was only going to yield the minors, I think was the impression I have from what I've read and heard.
Yeah, so the White Sox in 64, they sent him down to get a little more seasoning. And then two things happen. To make room for him, as you had mentioned, the White Sox gave up on a guy who ultimately would win two Cy Young Awards, Denny McClain, the last 30-game winner in baseball. And in his time in the minors during that period, DeBuscher goes 25-9 for the White Sox AAA team in Indianapolis. So he's pitching well enough to prove that he should be called up. But no matter what he did, it just wasn't enough. So how frustrated did he become, and how much did this frustration ultimately lead to his choice to abandon what might have been a pretty good baseball career? And I guess that goes to I don't know if you know this or you can weigh it. Did he have more love for one sport over the other?
From the stuff I've read, I didn't get a sense of that. I think he was just such a competitor and loved the sports. But I think that competitive aspect, like anything, he felt like he'd done what needed to be done in the White Sox farm system with Indianapolis. And, it's like, what are we waiting on here? I've earned the spot. They didn't give it to him. And unlike some other people, Denny McClain, for instance, who's, kind of cut loose, at least by the White Sox,
obviously
he gets picked up by the Tigers, DeBuscher had an alternative.
Sure.
And by that point, he had established himself in the NBA. So it wasn't like he was giving up the minor leagues in baseball for the end of the bench. In the NBA. At that point, the Pistons are talking about the coaching job. He had established himself as an all-star, or at the early part, at least a near all-star. I mean, his rookie year, he makes the all-rookie team, starting to make the all-defensive team. So, I mean, he'd established himself as a very, very solid NBA player as opposed to still toiling in the minor leagues in baseball.
Right. So now, before we get to what the Pistons did to really entice Dave to leave baseball and totally commit to basketball, which you have, you know, hinted towards a couple of times. I want to talk, if you can, a little bit about the correlation between the two sports. We all know about Deion Sanders and his attempt to play baseball and football at the same time. And we all know about Bo Jackson, who just might have been the best two-sport star we've ever seen when he played for the Royals and the Raiders. Yep. But there are several who played basketball and baseball. Gene Conley played for the Celtics, and I believe it was the Boston Braves. He's the only guy ever to win a championship ring in two different sports. Danny Ainge did it. He played for the Blue Jays and the Celtics. There was Ron Reed and Bob Gibson. I had no idea about Bob Gibson. You actually told me that.
Yep.
So
Bob
tell
Gibson
me,
played, was a quality player, basketball player at Creighton University, was deemed NBA caliber. I think he was drafted, but I'm not 100% certain of that. But he actually, to pick up some extra money, played with the Harlem Globetrotters.
Wow.
Which I've always found very funny because, you know, any baseball fan has the image of the grimacing,
yeah,
you know, just beyond intense Gibson on the mound and the idea of him playing with the Globetrotters. And I read one place that he roomed with Meadowlark Lemon, which adds a whole other dimension of hard to believe.
Very cool. Yeah, that's a tough one to imagine. This guy who would... He was not afraid to knock you down, and then he goes out and he has fun on a basketball court with the Harlem Globetrotters. You talk about a conflict. Wow.
Another one who played both sports was Chuck Connors, who later made a career in acting, but stayed involved with baseball enough, according to one thing I've read fairly recently, that he apparently was the go-between between the Dodgers and Koufax and Drysdale the year of the great holdout.
How difficult, you know, sort of a rhetorical question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How difficult is it to play two sports at once? And I'm not sure, was it different back then as opposed to it is today? And why do you think there, and is there a correlation between basketball and baseball? Or is it just that, you know, one's sort of a summer sport and one's a winter sport?
I would think it's more the summer than winter. I mean, and I say that as much as anything from just watching kids play in terms of the sequence. You know, they're playing off. I mean, you know, it's not the norm anymore because kids do specialize so early. But for a long time, you had, you know, your good high school athletes were football, basketball, and baseball. And a real good baseball player, it was kind of extending through into the summer. But I think that's a piece of it. Football is obviously more of a physical grind. But I think another piece that we sometimes tend to forget is that for an athlete like that, an athlete in the Buschers era, Gene Conley, any of those guys we've talked about, Danny Ainge is just a little bit before it, those were baseball players who were working in the off season. So basketball provided that work, and it was also a way to stay in shape, you know, as opposed to the guy who was doing PR. You know, we hear it the old days, the guy who would, you know, work for a local car dealer or something because they weren't making, you know, that much money. I mean, you know, we all celebrated the recent World Series a couple generations ago. That win was as much about the World Series share for a player as it was about any rings and publicity and the rest of it.
Yeah, that's an interesting
they used
point.
To tell that old story. The Yankees used to talk about it, saying, you know, in the days of their dominance, any newcomer near the end of the year, they got warned by the veterans, you know, don't screw up my playoff share kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. I never thought about that, that back then you would work during the off season. And if you're going to work during the off season, why not do it playing a sport as opposed to selling a car or insurance or, you know, chopping down trees, whatever it is. Interesting.
Right.
So the Pistons wanted Dave to commit to basketball and give up baseball. At first, he wouldn't do it, but then Detroit did something incredible. The Buscher, at the young age of 24, was named as the team's player coach. I mean, I can't even fathom being a player coach to begin with. And then you do it at the age of 24. Holy smokes. He's the youngest coach in the history of the NBA. it was quite a gamble, and it's a gamble that paid off for the Pistons. And even though Dave didn't meet with a lot of success as a coach, it still helped him become a Hall of Fame forward. Tell me about the move, how unusual it was, and how it was the one move that convinced Dave DeBuscher to end his baseball career.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a tremendously unusual move on many levels. The player-coach aspect is beyond unusual, especially for basketball that moves so fast and has so many elements that come from the bench. His age was just unfathomable in terms of having that responsibility. And, you know, we'll occasionally get a young coach in another sport who has a couple veterans who are older than he is. Occasionally it happens in the NFL. Occasionally it happens in Major League Baseball. But, you know, to basically be not much older than the guys coming right out of college on an NBA team is hard to fathom. And just, again, when you're also arguably your team's best player, to try to balance that, it's one thing if you're in more of a supportive role and you're kind of doing the others. But they were nowhere without his play on the court, which made it that much more of a challenge.
How did the other players react to that? The other players on the team, particularly the older players on the team, how did they react to the fact that this 24-year-old kid, who, as you just said, was probably the best player on the team, was named the player coach? How did that go over?
From everything I've read, I don't think there was the kind of resentment that there could have been, in part because of the kind of guy and the kind of player that DeBuscher was. He was such a leader by example. He was such a workhorse that there wasn't any resentment and that kind of thing. He to the degree you can say he'd earned it, he had, although I think it was realistically both a combination perhaps of a publicity stunt in terms of the attention from the owner or the incentive to come on, you know, I'm giving you all this responsibility, surely this is going to be your only sport, type of thing. But I think the nature of how he interacted with his teammates at all levels made it something that could work in a way that it wouldn't in lots of situations where, you know, even today you get, you know, players who don't fit in with the rest of their team because they are such a prima donna. And, you know, nobody ever accused DeBuscher of that kind of thing. His, you know, his loyalty to his teammates. And I say just he was the embodiment of leadership by example, as well as substantive leadership. He was not above, you know, at any point telling a teammate that they needed to be, you know, step it up kind of thing. But I think it was that, you know, the day-to-day stuff among your teammates was the bigger aspect of things, especially stepping into that role.
But it also affected his play on the court, did it not? I mean, here he had to dive in and look at the game a little bit different, and he had to take on these other responsibilities as the coach. How did that affect his game?
Yeah, his numbers weren't as good. You know, he was distracted, arguably, in the sense that, or just that you just can't do it. You can't play at that level and still be able to coach. You know, an assistant coach is going to help you notwithstanding. It's just it's too much, especially I think I would argue in that game, arguably more than any other, just because of the major sports, just because of the speed. So it impacted things, and I think it pulled at him. You know, he loved to play. He was a competitor. And certainly coaches get that kind of thing. But, I mean, he was way too young to envision himself kind of sitting on the bench, even to watch the rest of his team do it, to analyze things. He was a player.
I also read where it was actually very difficult for him to make trades because there was only one player on the team that the other GMs actually found marketable. And it happened to be him. Tell me about that. Yeah. That's got to be that's pretty funny.
I mean, it was hard. You know, it probably made it a little bit easier to coach because he was the centerpiece. But at the same time, you know, hard to build a team and can only be frustrating. I mean, he understood the game of basketball way, way too well to ever think, excuse me, that he could do it all. So to not have the other players around him, I mean, I think that was a a piece of it. I mean, you know, and he never, ever said anything about how pleased he was to get traded to the Knicks when that happened, because he knew that he was finally getting the kind of support and being put in the kind of situation that he had always longed for and could only see at a distance when he was with the Pistons.
Right. So how did the trade to the Knicks come about?
The Knicks were struggling. They'd gotten the pieces together. It was the team that finally won the championship was comparatively young. They'd drafted Willis Reed a couple of years before, drafted Bradley and Frazier. Bradley had to serve, first after the original draft. Again, as a territorial, because of the way the NBA worked in those days, he did his time in England as a Rhodes Scholar, and then in the interim they continued to be bad and got Walt Frazier, who was really kind of a little bit under the radar because he played for a small-name school at Southern Illinois. So they were starting to put the pieces together, but they weren't quite fitting. And Reed had been a center at one point, and then Bellamy had come in and took over, and Reed was playing forward where he wasn't comfortable. And, you know, the Pistons were flailing, and the Knicks inquired into that, and they were willing to trade Bellamy, who at that point, you know, had been an all-star. I mean, at that point in time, he was usually considered among the top centers in the league, not the same level, obviously, as Russell and Chamberlain and all, but kind of in a second tier behind them and, you know, Nate Thurman and some of those other guys. But they were willing to get rid of him, allowed Reed to come back to center, and really provided the other piece of the trade was Howard Komives, who was the starting guard, but it kind of freed up. It put the ball in the hands of Frazier as the point guard and move Reed back to center. And it was just that was a five, the Bushman Bradley up front, Reed in the middle, and Frazier and Dick Barnett, who was another savvy player, often, underestimated, who they'd gotten a couple years before. He played out in the, when actually Gail Goodrich had kind of replaced him with the Lakers. He played next to Jerry West for a while, but so it was a real combination of sharp guys who really knew basketball, and then they also made a coaching change at the same time, was when Red Holtzman came in and replaced Dick McGuire.
And I'm sure Holtzman knew what he was doing when he wanted the Busher. He knew that was the guy to.
Yeah, the Busher was very much his kind of guy, very much an open man kind of thing in terms of looking for the offense, and just a really tough. I mean, everybody said that Holtzman was a defensive coach and he left the offense to the players. So all he kept telling them was, find the open man. But the Busher fit that perfectly. It wasn't, he'd play defense all day long. You give him the open shot, he'd hit it, but he'd also spend as much time finding those other guys open. I mean, they were, so what's the Knicks in those days? It was basketball as I'll admit to being old fashioned as I think it should be played. I mean, it was a real team game. I sometimes in my more cynical moments see the modern NBA as 5 one-on-one games spread around kind of thing. But there was a tremendous amount of it was a different game, and some of it's the physicality. I mean, it was a different ball game, but it was really, it was fun basketball to watch.
So he was really the missing piece. And the interesting thing about it to me is that he is the guy who actually turned the New York Knicks from a contender into a championship team. It was really DeBuscher because, as you said, the other players, particularly Willis Reed, was able to move back to center. And yet, when you think of the Knicks back then, and when you think of the Knicks from back then, people will automatically think of Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, and Bill Bradley. Why not Dave DeBuscher? Why not Dave DeBuscher?
It's an interesting question, but I think it says a lot about DeBuscher. Reed had a great career, and obviously, as I say, that seventh game coming in out of the tunnel was epic and arguably the greatest single memory in Knick history, in large part because of what happened to him, and then hitting the jumper to start the game too, when he could barely get off the floor for the tap. It was huge, but I think Bradley obviously had all of the fanfare before he even got to the Knicks, and Frazier had a style that New York loved, and went to town
Clyde.
With. and the Buescher, right, Clyde. And but I think, you know, but the Buescher was the below the radar type that just, but it didn't happen without him, and he didn't care. I mean, it's really interesting to see that. He reveled in, and part of it was probably after his years with the Pistons, and even his earlier career. I mean, you know, you cited earlier all of those various championships going back to high school that he had led, and he was always the star, always a modest, understated star. But I think everything I've seen and the impression I have and the sense of camaraderie that I have always gotten a sense of at the time when you read it and the stuff that's come out ever since, of that Knick team, I think Dave the Buescher loved being a part of a team that was that good, because he had so seldom had that team aspect of things, and he certainly hadn't had it in Detroit.
Sure. Was it the Buescher who played center for the Knicks when Reed went to the bench in Game 7?
Yeah. When they went to that status, and he basically was covering Chamberlain as well as anybody could, and they kept rotating in. Dave Stallworth did a bunch, but he and Bradley were a little more on the wings. They played. They did what kind of almost a zone defense of a sort, and they moved to a zone offense similarly to try to keep on the wings away from Chamberlain in the middle. But Buescher was the one who was knocking bodies with Wilt, and that was no easy task.
No, not at all.
Something Reed could do better than any.
Right. So he was a key ingredient to the Knicks, perhaps the key ingredient. We all remember Willis Reed and Walt Frazier and Bill Bradley, as I said earlier. But basketball purists, the guys who know the game, the guys who cover the game, knew about the Buescher, knew how key he was, knew how great he was, and ultimately he ended up in the Hall of Fame. How great an honor for him.
Yeah, and he was on that, you know, the couple of years ago, or actually, no, it's more than a couple now, but when the NBA did its big 50th anniversary celebration and picked its 50 top all-time players, he was in that group too. And I think that also was a very fitting recognition of the kind of game he played and the contributions he made too.
Why did he only play 12 years?
Best I can tell, he wore out. I mean, we think of it as 12 years, but if you, and it was an intense 12, given the other stuff. But if you add those baseball seasons on top of it, it starts to push a considerably higher number of intense professional athletic seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the impression I've had was that he was feeling it. A part of me wonders too if. Because by the last year that he played, the Knicks had started the downturn. Bradley had retired. Reed's injuries had caught up to him. And a part of me can't help but wonder, as competitive as he was, and given the kind of roller coaster he'd been on that had finished on a high note, that it was like, I don't need to play out the string with some losing teams kind of thing.
Right.
I don't get any sense that anybody wanted to push him out. They knew the value was still there. I mean, his final season was statistically one of his best. I think it was his second highest scoring seasons, and he was still right up there, double figures, rebounds kind of thing, which is always a hallmark. So it was just, I think he had enough. He had three kids of an age where fathers, if they can, would like to be around him.
He wasn't done with basketball after he retired from the Knicks. He goes on to the ABA, the American Basketball Association,
right,
and becomes general manager of the new team, the New York Nets. Tell me about that.
Well, I think, you know, again, I think he looked, the way I understand it, he looked for some spots. The Knicks didn't have anything. He was settled in the area, so he didn't want to go outside. Again, the family was an important part. His wife was his high school sweetheart, and so the idea he was settled out in Long Island, and so staying in that area was important to him. And I think he probably felt too, given his experience, that he had something to offer to a up and coming organization like that. The Knicks were not real thrilled, from all reports, that because at that point we tend to forget it now, since a lot of those teams moved into the NBA. But you know, there was a war. right. the ABA and the NBA.
And he played
was not happy about it, and when one of their he added a lot of credibility to that.
Right, he played a key role in that because after being the GM of the Nets, he moved on to become the commissioner of the ABA,
and he
was played a key role in the merger where the Nets, the Pacers, the Nuggets, and the Spurs all went from the ABA to the NBA. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I think that that was also reflective of his stature that he had that. With the NBA people, it was a symbol of, all right, if a guy like him is involved with the ABA, it can't be that horrible. He could, he knew those people. He could talk to those people. But the loyalties, New York being what they are, there are more than a few people who speculate that the delay in retiring his jersey by the Knicks was in part a product of his involvement with the enemy, so to speak.
Interesting.
Happily, the Knicks came to their understood the greater value.
Yeah, there was sort of a cold period between DeBuscher and the Knicks, and that's because of his involvement with the Nets and the ABA.
Right, and then of course, ironically, he does come back to the Knicks
for one of the Knicks' greatest moments, the NBA draft lottery, the first ever draft lottery, and I could still see that day.
I remember watching it, and I can still see his face. When he realized they had the first choice, he looked as excited there as he had when they'd won the championship.
Absolutely. And they go on to pick Patrick Ewing with that pick. Tell us about Dave's days with the Knicks as an executive and the disappointment that he must have experienced over the fact that even with Patrick Ewing, the cornerstone to what he had hoped would be a new era of New York Knicks championship basketball, and they made the finals, but they could never get over the hump.
Right. Yeah. No. I think it was very, very frustrating. But it was that element. I think if you really looked at those teams, and Patrick's an example of the reality that it does take a team. They had the centerpiece. But they were never able to get the full set of pieces in the way that the Knicks that the Buscher had played on were able to. Let's say it's that complementary stuff, and that's why I think the Knicks of that era were really a special group. There was a lot of talent, but it was a talent that built off of each other. Dave DeBuscher had been a great Piston, but he was an even better Nick because they played off those things. Bradley's was a guy who played best within a system like that. Reed was a very effective center for that kind of a team too. It was a centerpiece on that. And the guards, Frazier, was a great point guard, did what he did, but he also, people tend to forget as good as he was, but defense was a centerpiece of his stuff, and that really played to his strengths. And he did what he needed to do on offense too. But the other people who bought into that. I mean, when Earl Monroe came and was on the second championship team, a guy nearing the end of his career who'd always struggled that same way, and finally he had a chance to be a piece of a winner. And in a one-on-one situation, he was still Earl the Pearl, but he didn't have to carry that team and made great contributions, but was not the same player either visually or statistically that he'd been with the then Bullets, because he had to be.
Right. I can't help but get this overwhelming feeling that Dave's final days with the Knicks were, and his final days in basketball were somewhat sad, and he just sort of like disappeared and he went away. What were those final days like? And then ultimately, he's out jogging and passes away. Tell me about those final days with the Knicks and what happened and how he passed.
Yeah, I think, the way I'm understanding it was one of those, the realities of the business side of the pros. He'd gotten the Ewing pick, had worked to put people around him, but when it didn't come to fruition, that was... Notwithstanding his history with the team, there was the proverbial, what have you done for me lately? And, he was fired as general manager, went to, worked for local corporation, kind of vice president, corporate development, you know, essentially PR, the kind of thing that more than a few athletes over time with their connections. And again, that, you know, Dave was at that point in time, Dave DeBuscher was, and within corporate circles for sure, a New York icon. You had the generation of those corporate leaders who remembered those Knick teams and hoped he could, serve in that capacity.
He was loved by New York, and he was definitely loved by his teammates. In fact, his former teammate and former senator of New Jersey gave the eulogy at Dave's funeral, Bill Bradley, right. And he said this.
Yeah. And a funeral that Bradley organized because he, as soon as he heard about it, he went to Buscher's wife, and she said, no, Dave didn't want anything. And Bradley was like, no, Dave deserves something, and we're going to do it.
Wow.
Well, he put it together according to Harvey Erickson's book, and which rings true, given that they were longtime roommates. And it rings true on a number of levels, because that sounds like DeBuscher, too, in terms of, it doesn't matter kind of thing. But as I say, I think it was reflective of Bradley's feeling. And the whole, everybody was there. And when Bradley gave the eulogy, and it was very much of a moment that symbolized that that team in that era.
And what he said, one of the things that Bradley said was, I think the fans loved Dave because they sensed what his teammates already knew. He was the real thing. No pretense. He hated phonies. No guile. He told you exactly how he felt. No greediness. I never heard him talk about points. No excuses. He always took responsibility for his mistakes. That says a lot about what kind of person Dave DeBuscher was. What should we remember about Dave DeBuscher? And again, I ask, why do you think, particularly outside of New York, he doesn't get the notoriety he should?
Well, I think it was, in many respects, all of those kinds of things. I think we tend now to focus on the glitz and the numbers. And, in the end, what Dave DeBuscher was, both in terms of his dealings with people and on the basketball court, was he was a winner in the best of that way. And it was, not accumulating rings, but I think equally important, he made everybody better. It was certainly true on those Knick teams as far as his teammates went, but I think Bradley's comment says it, I made them better as people too, reminding them that it's not about the point, it's about what we are all doing as a joint venture. And I don't think that's any small thing, but something that is oftentimes lost.
Wow, that's awesome. Hey, Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes, and I hope you'd consider coming back again sometime.
I would love to. I really enjoyed this, this was a topic that really means a lot to me, but I really enjoyed the opportunity.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The reason I chose to do a podcast about Dave DeBuscher is this. In New York, he's basically a legend. Outside of the Big Apple, however, very few people remember him. And the fact that he played for the Pistons and was the team's player coach at the ripe young age of 24 is something very few people remember. In fact, I have a very good friend who lived in Detroit, grew up a Pistons fan, and had no idea that DeBuscher was the team's player coach. And add to the fact that he was a two-sport star, having pitched for the Chicago White Sox, is even more remarkable. As we talked about earlier, the White Sox never really gave DeBuscher an opportunity to shine at the major league level. He only played parts of two seasons with the team, and, obviously, we'll never know how good he could have been. On the hardwood, however, it's a completely different story. DeBuscher was named one of the NBA's 50 greatest players. He was elected into the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame in 1983. He played 7 seasons with Detroit and 6 with New York. For his career, he averaged 16.1 points per game and 11 rebounds per game. He played in 8 NBA All-Star games, and he won an NBA championship with the Knicks. Later, he became the commissioner of the ABA and helped engineer the merger where the New York Nets, Indiana Pacers, Denver Nuggets, and San Antonio Spurs all joined the NBA. As the Pistons player coach, Buescher didn't fare too well, going 79 and 143 in his 3 years. But at the age of 24, what should you expect? He was playing and coaching. Just remarkable. He's the only player in the history of the game to be named player coach and then traded. Again, a remarkable, remarkable career. Next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to stay in New York and at Madison Square Garden to talk about one of the key members to one of the greatest periods in the history of the New York Rangers, the early 1970s, Vic Hadfield. Thanks again to today's guest, Bill Pruden, and we'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.